I had a piece of literature come to my attention. I think everyone should read this, and if you don't have it, you can probably get it off of our website, I believe. It's called Secular Dominance and Christian Hypocrisy. It's written by Jim Josephson. So if anyone can get this, they really need to and read it. It's an update on our Christian religion, on the religion of the one true God, and what is happening, the decline of it in this nation. So if you can get this, I would advise you to do so. It has to do with also with some prophecy, of course. A lot of this we know is coming to pass because of prophecy. Speaking of prophecy, it's a big thing in our day and age because we know that we are in the end times. We see the signs. We see our decline in our nation, our blessings dwindling. We have problems on every front. If there was to be a title to this message, it would be The Heavenly Signs. With that, I'd like us to go to Matthew 24 and verse 27. The Heavenly Signs. I'd like to ask a question before I get started. Where do you want to be when the heavenly signs appear? Everyone will see them. Right here in verse 27 it says, "For as lightning that comes from the east is visible even in the west, so will the coming of the Son of Man." But where do you want to be at this time? Do you want to be standing there looking up and seeing the skies being rolled back? And do you want to be present at that time? Well, to answer that question, let's read a little further. Let's go into this a little bit. So if you drop down to verse 30, it says, "At that time the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and all the nations of the earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of the sky with power and great glory." Okay, let's stop right there. First of all, there seems to be this idea about a secret rapture. This seems to negate that. And this is saying something far different. It's saying that everyone will see it. Everyone will see the heavenly signs appear. Everyone who is on earth at that time, that is. Let's go to Revelation chapter 1 and verse 7. Let's look at this a little bit more. Verse 7 reads, chapter 1, verse 7 reads, "Look, he is coming with the clouds, and everyone will see him, even those who pierced him, and all the peoples of the earth will mourn because of him. So shall it be. Amen." Okay, one interesting thing here. Not only will they see him, but they will be mourning. So it seems to me that what he's saying is that, what the Bible is saying is that if you're present at this time and you are alive and mortally alive, that is, and you're standing here on earth and you're looking up and you see this, chances are you will be mourning. So it's a good thing and bad thing also. Let's turn back a couple of pages in Matthew to Matthew 13, 31. Matthew 13 and verse 31. This is the parable of the mustard seed and the yeast. This is Christ speaking. It says, "He told them another parable. The kingdom is like a mustard seed, which a man took and planted in his field. Though it is the smallest of all our seeds, yet when it grows, it is the largest of the garden plants and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and perch in its branches. So the kingdom that is to come is going to start out very small, but it is going to encompass such a great area and grow so big that even the birds of the field, the animals that live in the field, will find refuge there. He told them still another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed into a large amount of flour until it worked through the whole dough. Well, it's also going to take over all aspects of our lives, of human life, of life on this planet. It is going to work through every facet of every bit of life here, every bit of thought. It's going to be like the water on the bottom of the sea, as it's written. Everyone will know God. Everyone will know the truth. And let's drop down to verse 36. Then he left the crowd and went into the house. His disciples came to him and said, "Explain to us the parable of the weeds in the field." And he answered, "The one who sowed the good seed is the Son of Man." And of course, we know that to be Jesus Christ himself. He came here, and the seed is the Spirit. The field is the world, and the good seed stands for the sons of the kingdom. Or should I say, the sons that are going to be eligible or worthy to be in the kingdom. And the weeds are the sons of the evil one, and the enemy who sows them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the harvesters are the angels. As the weeds are pulled up and burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will weed out of his kingdom everything that causes sin and all who do evil. They will throw them into the fiery furnace. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has an ear, let him hear. So this is also referring to the signs or the future that is coming. There will be people who will be subject to this, just as they are at the coming of Christ when they see him in the clouds. They will know that it is basically too late for them. Let's read a little further. Verse 32. Let's go back to Matthew 24 and verse 32. "Now learn this lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see all these things, you know that it is near, right at the door. I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Heaven and earth will not pass away, but the word will never pass away." So what he's saying here is that the word, this Bible, is going to outlast everything. And it will be here until all things have been fulfilled. The generation that lead up to the time of the second coming will be subject to all things until then. And this, in the last generation, there will be a generation that the end times will encompass. So. Well, let's read on a little further. It says, "No one knows about that day or the hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but the Father only. As it was in the days of Noah, so will it be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in those days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day Noah enter the ark? Well, Noah lived 100 years building the ark, or he spent 100 years building the ark. And all the people around there noticed that, of course, they knew it. But he converted no one. The only ones that entered the ark were his family. Well, there's a message going out every day. The truth is here every day. There are a lot of people who know that the Sabbath is to be kept, holy days are to be kept, but they refuse to do it. Let's read on a little further. And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be in the field, one will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken and the other left. Well, do you want to be the one that is left or the one that is taken? It's a good question. Let's go to Revelation. Revelation 20. Revelation 20, and let's start in verse 10. At the end of the age, when all things are done, it's speaking here of a time of judgment. And this is goes along with the first question I asked, where do you want to be at this time? And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of burning sulfur, where the beast and the false prophet had been thrown. They will be tormented day and night forever and ever. That means that actually the devil and his demons will be tormented forever and ever, but the beast and the false prophet being humans will be burned up in a minute, in an instant. Then I saw a great white throne, and him who sat on it. The earth and the sky fled away from his presence, and there was no place for them. And I saw the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne, and the books were open. Another book was open, which is the book of life. The dead were judged according to what they had done, as recorded in the books. The sea gave up the dead that were in it, and the death and Hades gave up the dead that were in them. And each person was judged according to what he had done. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. The lake of fire is the second death. Now that's one thing that we don't want. We do not want the second death. So if we are not obeying what God wants us to do today, we are not obeying the Sabbath, we are not obeying the holy days, then we may end up here at this judgment point. We don't know how long we're going to live. We could have today, we may be gone tomorrow, we may be gone next week, but we do know that sooner or later, being physical, that we will die, and we will be subject to judgment. So I just want to ask everyone, what are you going to be thinking when you look up and you see the heavens open, and you realize that it's too late. It's too late to open your eyes. It's too late to keep the Sabbath. It's too late to keep the commandments of God, to keep the feast days. Too late to honor God, the one great God, gives us all life, even life future in the future. It's too late to bend those knees in prayer. It's too late to worship the one true God. It's too late to repent. It's too late to stop sinning. It's too late to be holy and to have your names written in the book of life, which is spoken right here in chapter 20 of Revelation. It's too late to have your names written there. And too late to be sealed by God from the tribulation that is coming. Yes, I'd like to ask you, what will you be thinking when you're looking up and seeing the heavenly signs, standing there and gnashing your teeth? Will you be mourning? I believe so. We, the elect, sigh and cry and mourn for you now because you have rejected the truth and held on to the idols that do not see and do not hear. Just as those who hear but do not perceive, and those who do not understand. The idols don't understand, they don't see either. There are many who know the truth, and now is the time to return to it. Jesus says, I am the door, and I knock. I ask you, will you open the door, that he may enter before it is too late? But one day it will be too late. And on that day, when you are looking up, what will you be thinking?
One more song, and then we'll have Dr. Ricks come up for the main message. Let's turn over to, well, open your books again, turn to page 59. Give ear unto my prayer, O Lord. As we pray, we've got to have that faith that He is hearing us.
Thank you, Byford. As I mentioned last week, we're people are downloading about 500,000 pages of data from our website, so there are people here with us electronically from around the world. Today I'm going to talk about the beast of Revelation 13. Obviously, this is a message that looks to the future, but you also have to look at the past of mankind to fully understand it. And someday, a charismatic, powerful political figure is going to come on the world scene. He will deceive the world, and even some people who have been in the Church of God, some of them will also be led astray. At least in part, to avoid that, we have to love Christ. We have to love the truth, and we have to know this book, the Bible, even especially regards to prophecy. And it'll be the last chapter of the story of mankind without God, kind of like the final chapter. Let's go to Revelation 13:1 and look at some of the details of this final scene in human history when this charismatic political figure comes on the scene in Europe somewhere. Revelation 13:1. When I stood upon the sea, they say the sea was more frightening to the Israelites, and so this is, and his description is more frightening than the second beast. This is looking at it from God's point of view. God sees him for what he really is, a very frightening, bestial, ravenous beast. But the world, of course, won't know that, at least not till near the very end. And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads, 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. By the way, the power in a beast is often in prophetic figure based on horns, like a bull with 2 powerful charging horns. Well, this last beast, you know, in the book of Daniel, this entire image of the Babylonian mystery religion, anti-God rulership, is like one image. But the last one, the last beast in the list, is going to be the most bestial, the most powerful. So he's got 10 horns and names of blasphemy. They're going to take names that only belong to God. And it'll be shocking. And most of the world won't get it. But we will get it because we'll be familiar with the words of the book of Revelation. And I'm saying most of the world won't know the prophecy. Because if they knew it, they'd say, wait a minute, I read about this. He must be the beast, the false prophet, because he's falling into that pattern. But they won't know the Bible. The Bible is being discredited and undermined every day. And this is God's perspective. Of course, man, the world will see him as a new Messiah, a great hero. Just to make a point, 1939, Times Magazine Man of the Year was Adolf Hitler, a picture of Adolf Hitler on the front cover. Many people, including the New York Times, saw him as a savior in Europe, or at least a master politician in Europe. And all during the 30s, right in the end of the 20s, Winston Churchill, who did write columns in the newspaper and was one of the most famous politicians in Britain, he kept saying, because he would slur, he says, Nazis, he'd slur the word, were dangerous and they were political criminals and Hitler was evil. And the press in England beat up on Churchill all through the 30s. He was what they called in the wilderness politically, a backbencher. The press beat him up. He's a warmonger. He's a troublemaker. Hitler isn't so bad. You know, well, at least many of them thought that. And they beat up on Churchill until right near the end, you know, after he invaded Poland and then the Eastern and then the Blitzkrieg and then he invaded Norway. And I think suddenly the British public said, wait a minute. Churchill was right. It took a little while, but I'm not saying they didn't. Right near the last couple years, I think they start to get disillusioned. But the point I'm getting at is, for many years, the press, And a good deal of the people of the world didn't see the beast for what he was. Same with Mussolini. He was praised. He made the trains run on time in Italy. He was thought of highly. People didn't realize just the level of evil they were facing. Next week, I want us to look at Daniel 7, which talks about this beast in more detail, and you'll see where some of the ideas of the beast are developed more. Remember, we did say when we started Revelation, we'd go occasionally to Daniel to develop some of the concepts. So next week, we'll go through Daniel 7 and look at the beast and get some additional background on it. That the Christians who received John's letter, the book of Revelation, would understand, because they would have been familiar with Daniel. Anyway, this is the image of the Babylonian false system. By the way, the Babylonian system is the true source of the Trinity. Originally, it was Nimrod, his wife Semiramis, and after he died, their son Tammuz coming back, and she had an immaculate conception, and, well, you know the story. That's the false Trinity. Verse 2, Revelation 13. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. When we get to Daniel, we'll see all that described. By the way, as the beast is described in Daniel 7, those three things are mentioned. A leopard is known for his absolute speed and stealth. And the leopard is clearly, Daniel predicted in advance, Alexander the Great, who conquered the entire known civilized world in 12 years. In those days, that was unbelievable speed. You know how travel was and how slow it was. You know, from all of Europe to India, until actually he cried because no place else left to conquer. I don't think they knew about China and it was a little too far to get to, but in those days. But basically, he conquered everything that could be conquered. And probably even pushed it beyond the boundaries, you know, from Egypt, North Africa, the whole thing. And of course, that was predicted well in advance by Daniel. And you'll see Daniel up there, 500 B.C. And he predicted. And then he also predicted that it would have four heads. When Alexander suddenly died, the four generals divided his empire up into king of the north, south, east, and west, which is a prophetic model, and we'll look at that in the book of Daniel in nearby weeks. Well, the second one in that model, Revelation 13, was the feet of a bear, you know, especially grizzly bears. You hear some Alaskan stories. Grizzly bears and polar bears are extremely large, powerful paws. They really crush the things that they get into. You can kind of, and people even imagine Russia as a lumbering bear. But that was the Medes and the Persian Empire, as described by Daniel. And then, of course, the lion, the king of beasts, the first of the Babylonian Empire. By the way, and I've seen this in many ancient history books, one of the symbols of the original Babylonian Empire was a lion with wings on his back. And you'll see that mentioned in Daniel. And you've probably seen a lot of statues in the British Museum and in ancient history books. But then the final beast, as Daniel describes it, and it's referred to here, the final beast is even more terrifying and powerful than all the rest of them, and different than all the rest of them when it comes to power and evil. Certainly when it comes to power, at least. And Daniel foresaw all of that. And think of what a wonderful thing it is to know that God has given us a glimpse of the future. One reason you can trust this book, because it predicted with an unerring accuracy, Daniel did, two or three centuries ahead of his time. Daniel foresaw, while he was in the Babylonian Empire, the fall of the Babylonian Empire. He foresaw and predicted the rise of the Medes and the Persians, and even mentioned the names of Cyrus and others who would specifically allow for the rebuilding of Israel. He also saw the rise of Alexander the Great. According to one history book I read, when Alexander the Great was making his move into the Middle East and expanding his empire, he came to Jerusalem, and the high priest, you know, rolled out the book because he had heard about the temple there and various, and the sundry things that had been there. And the high priest told him that we believe you are mentioned in this book as a, you know, the one who will conquer the world through speed. All I can say is, if that story is true, can you imagine the confidence to give Alexander the Great to know that this one of the most sacred holy books predicts that he will succeed? And actually, in some of his most famous battles where he was outnumbered more than 2-1, he took daring chances as if he believed the gods were with him and he couldn't lose. And I guess they were, and he didn't, as the saying goes. The point I'm making is the Bible predicted this far in advance. And it also predicts the future. It predicts that the Holy Roman Empire is coming back one final time. It really does predict that. Think about something that you probably already know. And that is, you know that the United Europe, was started with the Treaty of Rome with six major European countries. And then they later took the term the Club of Rome. And 2 years ago, they tried to create, among the 25 nations that were there, a secular nation without involving the church. And the Pope opposed it. He said, no, don't do it. And they thought they had it made. They really did. A lady's coming up, honey. Would you go talk to her? She's coming up to the front door, the other side. And you all know the people of Europe, to the shock of the politicians, voted it down. They could not create a secular empire because it's not prophesied. It's going to be church and state working together in some sort of, we'll get to the second beast later, the false prophet. We'll get to him at another time. But it is coming. And going on Revelation 13, and the dragon gave him his power, his seat, and his great authority. Think about that. The devil gives him his power. The devil is behind him. And let's go to 2 Corinthians 11:13. And put your marker, hold your marker, we can go back quickly to Revelation in a little while, but 2 Corinthians 11:13. Paul writes to the Corinthians and he says, because I'm sure they were under a lot of attack from bad influences in Corinth, Paul says, for such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves, like the transformer toy from one thing to another, transforming themselves into the apostles of Christ. And no marvel, for Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light. Therefore, it's no great thing if his ministers, and that includes his greatest minister of all, the beast, will be transformed into ministers of righteousness, who end shall be according to their works. In other words, he's going to get thrown in the lake of fire because his works are evil, but people will think he is a man of light and greatness. And Satan will use the beast. And I want to ask the question, how can Satan and the beast deceive the world? How? Part of the how is that people do not love the truth. Really, you can talk to people, and if something doesn't fit the way their ego wants to see it or to their advantage, they could care less. People do not love the truth. We have to learn to love God and to know God. And to know God, we have to know his word. We have to know truth. You know, it says in Isaiah 5 that they're going to start calling hot, cold, and good, bad. We're starting to see that in society. They're moving far away from the truth. And there's a story I heard in this, it was on a computer tape. This man had met a young lady in South Africa. He was a famous author, and then he This is back in the days of the old sailing ship, so it took a while to get there. Then he went back to Europe, and then he telegraphed her and gave her a marriage proposal. And she telegraphed back, well, I'll think about it. He said, I'm on my way, which means he'll be there in 6, 7, or 8 weeks by ship. So what do you think she did during the time on his trip there? She got all his books and read them. Because she wanted to know something about this guy if she was going to decide to marry him. Well, since we're the bride of Christ, if we love Christ, we need to read his books. Get to know him. The world does not know the Bible. I've wondered, you know the story that we covered in Bible study in Revelation 11, where the two witnesses are finally killed after mentally tormenting the world with the truth. And everybody celebrates it. You know, the two witnesses are dead day. We got them. You know, they're all celebrating. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. If they knew the Bible, they'd realize, uh-oh, this fits Revelation too much. And then a few days, this guy's going to wake up, come back to life, and that means we're going to get zapped really hard right after that. They'd get scared. But why doesn't that happen? Why is the world celebrating? Because they don't know the Bible. They're unfamiliar with the prophecies, and maybe the few religious leaders that are have been corrupted and compromised. Because otherwise, they'd know better. But if we love God and know his word, we cannot be deceived. Let's go to John 13. I'm going to talk for a minute about just loving God, and we hope to make this the theme of the feast. And if you can come to one of the feasts of the Intercontinental Church of God this year, we're going to try to make it a feast-wide theme, and hope that you can, if possible. John 13, 34. A new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. One of the things the devil does to destroy people is he gets a root of bitterness going between brethren or whoever. And it's like a poison. Like if you get a tick bite and he's got Lyme, if you get it treated right away, it doesn't spread throughout your system. You'll probably be just fine. But if you ignore it and it spreads, it grows and grows, it will spiritually destroy you. Same with roots of bitterness. If you chew on it and ruminate on it, it'll get bigger and it'll spiritually destroy you. We Christians shouldn't do that. Verse 14, just a few lines over as John is writing it. 14:15. If you love me, keep my commandments. In other words, we love one another as a sign, and we love God. And if we love God, we keep his commandments. So a theme for the feast could be love, you know, which includes forgiveness, fellowship, and commandment keeping. Love, fellowship, and commandment keeping. And let's go to 2 Thessalonians 2. This is the great falling away statement. The way it's written, though it doesn't use the term great falling away, it's understood that this is not just an average, you know, every now and then somebody falls away from the church. It's a great falling away. So Paul is writing the church. We'll pick it up in verse 2, 2 Thessalonians 2:2. That you be not soon shaken in your mind or be troubled, neither by spirit nor by word nor by letter, because there are probably false letters circulating, we think, as well as false apostles, as from us, as of the day of Christ is at hand. Let no man deceive you by any means. In other words, he's speaking of the day of the Lord, the end of the age, the last chapter of mankind. For that day, the last chapter, shall not come except there come a falling away first. Or a better translation, a great, significant falling away first. And the man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. In other words, this man of sin, before he comes, is going to be a falling away in God's church. And some who are, at least were in God's church, will be in a position to be deceived when the beast comes. And you're going to say, but how is that possible? If you had asked me 37 or 8 years ago, when Worldwide Church was at its peak about 1972, I think that was its peak size, probably over 100,000, 3 colleges, I would have said, it could never happen. We thought, well, it'll just be a few bad news, lukewarm, later sin people fall away. But, you know, the more I thought about it, that scripture did imply, because you can't fall if you're not standing. In other words, the world can't fall away because they're already on the floor. I mean, they're already deceived. A falling away implies you have to be standing up, knowing the truth, and then you fall down. So the only way that can make sense is a significant, great falling away from the truth of God before Christ comes back. And people get little bitterness, or they get very sins of lust, or whatever it is, and it grows and grows, and then they, whatever they do, before you know it, they're no longer in good spiritual influences, and then they get frustrated, and then they drop out, or they go off into worldly things, worldly churches. And I just amazed the people who used to be in God's church who are now not keeping the Sabbath, keeping Christmas. Tens of thousands. That's all I can say. And I think that great falling away is not over. It's still happening. A little chunk here, a little chunk there. It's still happening. And who knows what clever things Satan has in the future. We probably underestimated his cleverness and the weakness of human nature. So the way to resist that is we have to love God. We have to know his word. For instance, if you really love God, you'll enjoy Bible study. And you'll enjoy our Bible study here. And you'll enjoy learning more. Now, you might say, well, you know, the Bible is kind of boring compared to, and then whatever you're going to compare it to. And my thought might be, okay, maybe that is true sometimes. But if you find it to be true of yourself, you should just ask God for help. Because like any other problem, if you say, God, I really want to enjoy the Bible studies and I really want to learn more, but I just, it's too much like school, it's too much, or personalities I like or don't like, ask God for help. And it's like anything else. If you need help, ask God, he'll give you the help so we can learn more. Now, I've got another corny story to tell you, and I hope that the meaning will be a good meaning. There's this... It's called the pregnant Miss Doofus. Mr. Doofus's daughter got pregnant. And the man is describing what happened. He says, the other day, my neighbor, Miss Doofus, came running up to me in the driveway, jumping for joy. I didn't know why she was jumping in the driveway for joy. I didn't know why she was so happy. He said, you know, why are you so happy? You're jumping up and down. He jumped up and down with her. And she said, I have some really great news. Tell me, why are you so happy? And she says, I am pregnant. Oh, that's great news. And even better than that, I'm going to have twins. Wow. And he was really surprised. Well, not just having one baby, but twins. He was amazed. He says, well, you're not really showing very much. I can hardly see any bulge. How do you know that you're pregnant, and how do you know it's twins? Well, she said, well, that's the easy part. I went to Sam's Club. We get things in bulk. And we bought one of these pregnancy kits. And we were able to buy at a good price the twin pack. Both tests came out positive. Anyway, the twin pack. But the point I'm going to try to squeeze out of that story is it's easy to let yourself be deceived if you want to be deceived. She wants to believe she's having twins, she'll believe it. And big media is helping to teach people, I believe, to learn to love lies. I really believe they're doing that. Whether they know it or not, they are. Okay, going back to Revelation 13, pulling my little cord here. Revelation 13, verse 3. And I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. Now, there are some historical models. By the way, Nero, whose name means 666 numerically, when he died, there were all kind of rumors he was going to come back to life. And many Christians feared it. And the Roman Empire actually started to fall apart after his death, but it miraculously got itself back together. And actually that happened to the Roman Empire on several occasions. But I believe this is Satan's attempt to create a false Messiah. You know, Jesus Christ was crucified. Was, you know, 3 days in Jewish world meant you were really dead. Because sometimes a person could be in a coma or stop breathing for a while, and then they come back. But 3 days, and you really were dead. They knew you were dead. You stayed in the grave underground for 3 days. You were dead. So he came back, and it clearly was a miraculous resurrection. I don't know exactly how the devil will do this and exactly what it means, but I'm sure it's an attempt to create a fake Messiah. A fake Messiah. You give him, maybe he goes into a coma and he's not really dead. I'm not exactly sure how the devil pulls it off, but something like that's going to happen. Something like that is going to happen. And they worshiped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? In other words, when we say they worship the beast, they literally worship the beast. He is worshiped like a god. And people will worship the man. And he'll take on blasphemous titles. Not just his holiness. You probably heard that one by certain clerics. But much more than that. And even listening to that tape, Mussolini and Hitler took some blasphemous titles. They actually claim that they had reinstituted the Holy Roman Empire, from 1925 to 1945. But people have worshipped them. Actually, Hitler was worshipped. And, you know, he said, I know how to say it in German, but I'll just say it in English. He said, you know, that I am Germany and Germany is me. And, you know, and patriotism required you to worship and pledge your personal allegiance to Adolf Hitler. And that was one of the big deals he made to disband his brown shirts, have the army pledge personal allegiance to him. Stalin had the people in Russia worship him, even though he was doing horrible things to them. It's one of those, he used their own Pravda, their own propaganda media, to get people to worship him. And millions were murdered by those two men. Mao Zedong did the same thing. His own little red book, and people worshipped him even though he did terrible things. These were beastly men, but somebody who's probably, at least in some ways, the epitome of all these bad men, but maybe with a little more charisma, is coming one final time. He's the worst of all. Let me just talk for a brief moment about emperor worship. And I want to describe the Roman Empire so we can understand why a lot of people in the Roman Empire thought it was worth it to worship the emperor. They all took the title Caesar after the original Julius Caesar. And after him, they got into that worshiping the emperor thing because the Roman Empire, actually, E Pluribus Unum, you know, one of America's models is taken from the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire actually was progressive for its day. They welcomed people in relative to the world of their day. It was prosperous. It lasted for over 1,000 years. They actually had roads which went all around the world, like from Persia all the way to Spain, all across North Africa, the Middle East, and back to Rome. And parts of those roads are still used to this day. That's how well built they were. They built some of the best roads in the world. And the civilized world, from Scotland all the way, as I say, to Persia and all of North Africa and Egypt, was all under one rulership, and they allowed religious freedom, and all kinds of religions were allowed. But they said, we need something to unify people. So what they did was, they said, once a year you have to burn incense to Caesar, whichever Caesar it was at the time. It was like what we might call the Pledge of Allegiance, but Christians knew that that went a little too far. Worshipping a man was beyond the pale, and they wouldn't do it. And Christians, you know, remember Romans 13, and they didn't try to overthrow the government. Most of the time, the Romans ignored it, and the Christians were allowed to get away with it. But every now and then, someone would come along who thought, well, we don't have any unity unless people do that. I'm sure the devil got into them, and they forced it. And we think some Christians probably did compromise, and that's part of when John is inspired to write in Revelation 2 or 3 about compromises with Jezebel and spiritual adultery. At least that's part of it. Going to the temple and once a year burning incense to Caesar is part of it. But most of the Christians heroically stood up to it. And they did great works that should be really admired. You realize that's coming back, don't you? And I don't know how they'll enforce it. And maybe you'll have credit cards and you won't be able to buy or sell unless you have the credit card and you have to maybe once a year go somewhere and worship a statue or a picture or however it's done of the new Caesar. Some variation of that is coming back. Now, most of us will be out in the wilderness in a place of safety. We won't have to worry about it. But those that are get converted at the last minute, as GTA said, they've heard our messages, but they don't do anything until it starts happening. Or people that God has chosen to be heroic martyrs, they will have to stand up against that pressure. And it's going to be, but we will know better. But the big thing is the rewards for resisting will be fabulous. And we just have to keep that in mind. If ever God chooses you to have to resist worshiping Caesar, whoever the new Caesar will be. Revelation 13, verse 5. And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. And power was given unto him to continue 42 months. That's 3.5 years. He's going to speak blasphemy. He'll have blasphemous titles. And let's read verse 10. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. In other words, he'll have help. And those people who do his dirty work, they will also suffer too. Just like, you know, Germany suffered terribly from following Hitler. Almost a whole generation of young men, or a good chunk of them, were destroyed in Germany. Almost every German city was rubble. They lost tremendous territory after World War II. And actually the first 1 or 2 years after the war, people died of starvation. In other words, Hitler was an absolute disaster to Germany. Well, the same will happen with this beast in the end. But they will live to regret it, but they won't know it till it's too late. But we, if we learn to love God, we can make a difference. We can make a difference. Going to verse 8. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him, that is, except for us, of course, whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. So, in other words, the converted people will not do it, but everybody else will do it. And we are going to win. Isn't it good to remember? Remember at Pentecost, Mark said, remember, in the end, we win. It's good to remember that. In the end, we win. Learn to love the truth and love God, because in the end, we will win. But remember, Nero was one of the first emperors to start to persecute the Christians. And actually, Christianity grew because of his persecution, because Christians handled it so nobly. And Domitian also did later, at a later time. And Christians were very heroic. And some of us will be called on to be heroic. And if we are, I hope that we will be heroic. Remember this. Love, fellowship, and obedience. That's how you learn to love God. And most of all, learn to know the Bible, to know prophecies. We're going to be studying them a lot in the next month or so. And even if some of the details we haven't completely figured out in the prophecies, because Daniel and Revelation, you know, the way they end, you get the impression that Daniel says, it's going to be sealed until the time of the end. In other words, there'll be some of these details we won't be able to quite fully decipher until we get close to the end. But we will know the words. We'll say, now I know what they mean. And we get there, we won't be able to be deceived because we will know the truth. And I think God will protect us because we love him and we love the truth. It'll prepare us. It'll warn us. And when we see the Holy Roman Empire built around 10 kings, like, say, the throne to the Hungarian-Austrian Empire, which actually was pretty big in Central and Eastern Europe, Say if that king or dictator gets reconstituted, he controls that big chunk of people, and then nine other kings, whatever their jurisdiction are, might even include part of what's now Russia and some of the other states that used to be part of Russia, at least the European half of it, could be part of it. It could be from the Ural Mountains to Portugal. Could all be part of one empire. And as we see America's military power strain in just Iraq and Afghanistan, I mean, unless America repents and God blesses us, of course, it's clear that America's ability to lead and stabilize the world is going to be declining for financial reasons and others that we clearly see. Like, they're not going to build this new advanced fighter, and we're going to probably lose our edge. And we see Europe step into that vacuum and 10 kings, and then suddenly a super king comes along and they all give their allegiance to him. When we see that, we will know that our reward is very near. Thank you.